Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Only with the backing of a broad and bipartisan coalition of supporters and broad bipartisan support in Congress, we can craft a bipartisan farm bill that delivers for the American people. This is how we accomplish our shared goals of a strong agricultural economy that supports communities all across the country. And I'm so pleased our committee works so closely together to do that.
The importance of coalitions outlined in a recent Senate Ag Committee hearing. Debbie Stabenow, chairwoman. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack talked about coalitions with growing smart solutions.
Every major commodity group is involved in this partnership initiative, and we have nearly 100 universities and colleges working to make sure that we do a proper reporting, verification, measurement, monitoring of the results.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The first report of the Commission of Agriculture after its first year of operation, after Abraham Lincoln established it in 1862, the commissioner, a fellow by the name of Isaac Newton, not the real Isaac Newton, but a different Isaac Newton, wrote a 632-page book about the activities of the department.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack spoke to attendees recently in Orlando at Commodity Classic.
And in that book, his first 25 pages is a preamble of his thoughts and theories and ideas about the department. And what he raised as concern was the consolidation of land ownership, suggesting that it was the consolidation of land ownership, it was the lack of a middle class in the great Roman Empire that ultimately led to the demise of that great Roman Empire. Fast forward and you think about the pivotal moments in our history of agriculture. In the New Deal, the Dust Bowl, confronted with just tremendous grief and pain, we put together a program, started focusing on conservation, created supply management, and for a period of time, farmers did pretty well. And then in the early 70s, Secretary Butts made the decision that it was appropriate and necessary for us to move away from that system to a more market-driven system, a focus on production. If you remember, he may have encouraged all of us to think about fence row to fence row. And so American farmers reacted and responded, and boy, did they do an amazing job. In my lifetime, the productivity of American farming has increased 17 times. It is a remarkable story of productivity. But the reality is that the more productive we became, the more expensive it was. And so it became necessary for folks to look at and to think about spreading the cost of that over a larger and larger base. And with that, we had larger and larger farms and fewer farmers. And it wasn't just the impact on the farmers. It was the impact on the communities where those farmers lived, those small towns, because if there are fewer farmers, then there are fewer customers for that small town business on the main street. There are fewer kids in the school. There are fewer folks living in the community that can support a hospital and a number of docks. And so rural America, which is, I think, the heartbeat of this notion of a middle class, began to be challenged.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack, recently at Commodity Classic. On Friday, USDA out with their cattle on feed report for the month of March. Cattle and calves on feed for the slaughter market. It's just looking at feedlots with a capacity of at least 1,000 head. 11.6 million head as of March the 1st. That inventory, 4% below the same time last year. Now, placements in feedlots during February, 7% below 2022 at 1.73 million head. And the net placements, 1.68 million head. Now, during February, placements of those under 600 pounds, 345,000 head. Those six weights were 315,000 head. There were 470,000 head of the seven weights, 424,000 of the eight weights, and 130,000 of the nine weights. 50,000 weighed more than 1,000 pounds. Marketings of fed cattle, 1.74 million head, 5% below 2022. It's a general reminder that the herd continues to contract. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Look, it's our first time, all of us together, dealing with a global pandemic.
Chris Spear is president and CEO of the American Trucking Association, testifying recently before the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee.
I mean, there were a lot of things thrown at our country, our economy, our industry, that we had to adjust to very quickly in order to make certain that store shelves had, you know, milk, eggs, bread, you know, gas stations had fuel. But then became the rush to get PPE, test kits, certainly the vaccine itself. That was moved largely by truck. And our industry stepped up to the plate when a lot of people stayed at home, not knowing, you know, what impact this would have on their health, their family's health, real concerns. And isolated in the cab, you know, with those risks still in their minds, they still got in the cab. They still drove those loads to where they needed to be. They were the glue, certainly in the early weeks and months of the pandemic. And I think the inclusiveness of government and industry to solve problems of this magnitude is absolutely essential. I can point to things where we had a lot of conflict between our government and the government of Canada. And our inability to match bearings with public safety and health policy to get our trucks across the line, their largest trading partner. We're dependent on one another. And it just took two governments sitting down to hammer that out, and they didn't do it. So that's leadership, and I'm not pointing fingers. It's just a reality that has an impact on an industry like ours to serve the populace, to serve society on the basic needs that they have to have. I think that... you know, when we looked at the OSHA announcement to require vaccines for employers with more than 100 employees, and my background coming off Senate Labor Committee, OSHA, at DOL, we knew, my team and I, that they did not have the authority to do that. We did not want to go to court. That was something that we certainly could have sat down and worked out, but would ended up litigating it. It went to the Supreme Court, 6-3 decision. You know the outcome. A lot of waste of time on issues that we really should be sitting down and working collectively toward.
Spear also talked about implementing a pilot program for 18-year-old drivers.
Like everything in this town, slower than we would like, but, you know, we've grown accustomed to it. I do think this program's going to bear fruit. We've worked really hard in this committee to create a bipartisan understanding of this block of talent, 18 to 20. But I'm also mindful, as you understand, that 49 states already allow an 18-year-old to drive. Class 8. They just can't cross state lines. Now, that works pretty good from Redding, California, down to San Diego. 20 minutes outside of Providence, Rhode Island, not so much. What we need to do is have good training and technology. None of the 49 states do that. This program that was put into the IIJ does. So we need to teach young talent how to safely and responsibly operate this equipment. Inserting an issue like forward-facing cameras, that was not part of the deal. That was not in the bill. And it's going to cause, that's a matter, by the way, that most companies and their employees should negotiate out. Having a camera in your face every minute of every hour of every workday, that's not in the bill. And it's going to limit companies from joining this program and putting young talent in a capacity where they can replace our aging workforce. So this is a concern. Oversight is needed. I applaud you for shedding some light on this. We need to follow the law that you handed the agency. And so that is one area where I think it's going to serve as a bit of a headwind in getting this program off the ground.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Since the last Farm Bill, we have made historic investments to address the unique challenges faced by these communities across the country.
At a recent Senate Ag Committee oversight hearing of USDA Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow on rural America.
New funding for programs like ReConnect is improving rural America's access to affordable high-speed internet, creating new opportunities to connect people to jobs and education and healthcare. Historic investments in affordable clean energy and energy efficiency upgrades are working to lower costs and create new good-paying jobs in our communities. We've also made progress to address the climate crisis by providing historic investments in long-standing, voluntary, and flexible Farm Bill conservation programs. For years, these popular bipartisan programs have been oversubscribed and underfunded. New funding for the programs like EQIP, RCPP, are allowing us to finally address the backlog of initiatives and strengthen these programs. We also know that our farmers are facing traditional and novel challenges. While USDA projects that net farm income will remain above the 20-year average, and many commodity prices are at historic highs, so too are land, fertilizer, and other input costs. This is making it challenging for our producers to maintain their operations. Since the last Farm Bill, farmers received $70 billion in assistance outside of Farm Bill programs, including over $13 billion in response to weather and climate disasters. They have devastated crops, forests, and livestock. This is why I will continue to fight to expand and strengthen crop insurance and the Farm Bill disaster assistance programs for all our farmers. The future of our food systems rely on the investments we make today. The 2018 Farm Bill included strong investments in agricultural research, which helps our farmers develop the tools they need in the face of the climate crisis and other emerging challenges. These investments, as well as Farm Bill programs that support the next generation of farmers and agriculture producers, are critical to long-term success of American agriculture. We must ensure that the Farm Bill continues to support the nutrition programs that serve as a lifeline to millions of people and families across the country. The SNAP program provides food assistance for more than 41 million Americans, 80% of which are children, seniors, veterans, and people with disabilities. The bipartisan 2018 Farm Bill directed a long overdue reevaluation of the Thrifty Food Plan, which had not been done since 1975, almost 50 years ago. This update resulted in a very modest increase to the average SNAP benefit of about $1.35 a day, an increase estimated to lift 2.4 million people, including a million children, out of poverty. Spending on nutrition programs does not rob resources from other Farm Bill programs, just as crop insurance doesn't rob resources from other programs when disasters hit and spending goes up. But threats that we are hearing from some, certainly not agricultural leaders, but some in the House, of reckless mandatory budget cuts will result in cuts to all Farm Bill programs, and I know that's something that no one in this committee wants. We cannot go backward at a time when our farmers and our families are counting on us to move forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Carbon markets, there are wildlife markets, there are water markets. There are 24 of these markets today in America.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack talks about qualifying for ecosystem service markets.
Hey. For conservation results, for environmental results, for greenhouse gas reductions, for carbon sequestration, for carbon storage results, which farmers are going to be able to provide. That's a new income source that didn't exist before. And with these investments that USDA is providing, the resources, the partnerships that we're developing, you not only have a new value-added opportunity, which is a new income source, but you also have ecosystem service markets. We're excited about that. And we're excited about the Inflation Reduction Act resources for conservation that give us the opportunity to ensure that as we learn what works from this, that we can funnel and provide additional resources. So instead of two or three ways to make money on that farm, now we have four or five ways to make money. We have the opportunity to expand significantly renewable energy production. With the Inflation Reduction Act, there's an historic amount of money in the Renewable Energy for America program where farmers can essentially on their own farm create a solar system or a windmill that allows them to produce their own energy, and maybe they produce excess energy which they can put on the grid, and as they put it on the grid, they get paid for it, and as they get paid for it, they have another income source. And this is going to be a massive opportunity. Why? Because RECs across the United States are going to, over time, decarbonize their systems. They're going to rely more and more and more on renewable systems and less on fossil fuel-based systems. And as they do, they're going to be looking for the generation and transmission capacity. That's a new income source that farmers can consider. And I fully appreciate the concerns that farmers have about the expanse of large-scale renewable energy. We want to make sure that we work with those who are interested in doing that to make sure that they're not taking highly productive land out of production, but that they're utilizing that opportunity for less productive land. So in turn, we have yet another income source.
And the excitement behind bio-based products.
We recently provided resources to a soybean company in Ames, Iowa, that is basically transitioning soybean oil into a thermoplastic rubber that is a low-cost paving product. In other words, it will help road construction and reduce the cost to counties and cities of road repairs. Folks, this is an amazing new opportunity to take an agricultural product and convert it into something more valuable. That does two things. It creates yet another revenue source for farmers, but it also creates processing jobs and manufacturing jobs in rural places. The Department of Agriculture has a bio-preferred program where we're encouraging federal agencies to buy bio-based products. There are 139 categories of those products. 139 categories. Within each category, there are numerous products. So we're talking about literally hundreds of opportunities to create new manufacturing and new opportunities for farmers. We all know about biofuels. We all know about the importance of continuing to stress E15, continue to stress the need for soy diesel, continue to focus on ways in which we can expand that traditional biofuel industry, but there's a new industry forthcoming. And that new industry is sustainable aviation fuel. You know, I get electric cars. I totally get them. You drive them. If the charge wears out, you pull to the side of the road, you pick up your cell phone, you call for a charge, you get back on the road. But seriously, what if you're in a plane and it's over a body of water? We need a sustainable low-carbon fuel. It's a 36-billion-gallon industry that doesn't exist today, for all intents and purposes. It's a new opportunity for American agriculture to lead the way.
It's agriculture today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The World Organization for Animal Health is an international institution. The United States is part of that.
Also known as the OIE, Kent Backus is with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
It's a science-based organization that is really focused on combating foreign animal disease and other animal health issues as they arise. Things like foot and mouth disease, BSE, high path avian influenza, African swine fever, all these devastating diseases. Well, you have this one central organization that many countries are part of. We all share information through that. Part of that is really just to keep each other up to date and make sure that people understand where events are happening so that they can take necessary actions, but also so that we can prevent and control the spread of a lot of these diseases. As a partner in the World Organization for Animal Health, the United States has agreed to report any of these occurring diseases within 24 hours. And that's something the U.S. has stayed true to. And that's why we have such a strong image and a trustworthy reputation throughout the globe.
Which is part of the reason why the cattle industry is upset with Brazil right now.
So the United States has some of the highest standards in the world when it comes to animal health and food safety. If you don't have healthy animals, you're not going to have a product. And if you don't have consumer confidence by having food safety, then you're not going to have much of a market either. So U.S. has always prioritized food safety and animal health. We have very strong science-based standards, which means that we believe in risk-based analysis. We believe in objective standards that are peer-reviewed and really look at science as the foundation for all of these things. But we also know that even if you have all the science in the world and you have the diagnostic capabilities, if you're not honest and straightforward in your reporting, then you don't have credibility and you don't have trust. So, partnered with that science-based approach is also the understanding that we have to be transparent. We have to engage. So that's something that the U.S. does. And because of that, we're well respected throughout the world. And really having that U.S. stamp of approval, it carries a lot, which is why so many countries want access to the U.S. Not only is this a good market to sell your products, but if you're good enough for the U.S. market, you're good enough for pretty much any other market in the world. And so, that credibility that we carry means quite a bit. But there is one country that has access here that we feel doesn't live up to those standards, and that's Brazil. And Brazil's standards, while they may look good on paper, in practice, we have a lot of questions. We have a lot of doubts. This latest atypical BSE case took 35 days to report. It takes us 24 hours. Brazil has said, we have to ship off some of these samples to other labs to be tested. Well, that may be true, But why does it take 35 days? Why does it take 35 days when you have other countries that are also having atypical BSE cases at the same time? It only takes them a matter of hours or just a couple of days. So I don't think that there's a clear justification. And even looking at the history of Brazil, there's been times when we've had to shut off, you know, their imports because of food safety violations. And the fact that their rejection rates were you know, significantly higher than a lot of other import sources, where the fact that they had some BSE cases where, you know, they had two atypical BSE cases where it took them several weeks to report. And again, there's one case where it took them almost, you know, 18 months to 2 years. That's unacceptable. And so how can we continue to trust a market that continues to kind of flaunt the rules? They don't have a right to the U.S. market. It's a privilege. And if you're not going to, you know, provide an equivalent level of safety and health and be able to back that up through your reputation, then you don't deserve to be here.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I know everyone in this room has heard me say this before, but based on the last census, 53 of 75 counties in Arkansas have lost population. That is 71% of Arkansas counties.
Expressing concern regarding rural America, ranking member of the Senate Ag Committee from Arkansas, Dr. John Bozeman.
Across the United States, 53% of our counties, or 1,660 out of 3,140, lost population in the last census. I'm certain that all my colleagues on this committee are concerned about the hollowing out of our states and our country and the impact that this will have on the future of America. I know this has been a major theme of yours, you know, as you've talked across America in the last 2 years. At the end of this farm bill process, I would like to go back to rural Arkansans and tell them that we put policies and programs in place that will improve their quality of life and give their children and their neighbors' children reason to return home. In my mind, ensuring this country has a vibrant and economically sustainable agriculture economy is key to accomplishing that goal. The headwinds for our producers are great. For only the third time in 55 years, we're expected to have a trade deficit in agriculture, and no two trade deals have been signed or are under negotiation. This will be the most expensive crop on record at $460 billion and follow last year's previous record of more than $440 billion. Farm debt is over half a trillion at $535 billion. Input costs are still high. Supply chains are easing but remain tight. Interest rates have rapidly increased and by percentage represent the largest cost increase our producers will face this year. Farm production costs have increased 28% or nearly $90 billion. Many do not understand the amount of capital required to farm these days. During the fiscal year 2022, the average size of the Farm Service Agency's guaranteed operating loans, often used for our young and beginning farmers and ranchers, was nearly $330,000. The capital cost of getting into agriculture is enormous, and farmers are going to have to rely more heavily on credit this year. How many other jobs require that you take out the loan the size of a mortgage or larger each year? And in order to pay that back, you must contend with the weather, the markets, the economy, and global politics. These are many of the reasons why when I meet with my farmers, they all tell me the safety net is badly frayed and needs to be reinforced. The 2014 Farm Bill was successful in moving agriculture away from direct payments to need-based support during times of low prices or low revenue. That was nearly a decade ago, and farm programs have not kept pace with the needs of modern agriculture and are not responsive in the face of pandemics or geopolitical pressures. The current safety net does not reflect the current levels of risk taken on each year by those that provide the food, fiber, and fuel we depend on. As we address these risks, it's critical that we not get consumed by a small farm versus big farm conflict. While 89% of the farms in the U.S. are classified as small by USDA and contribute nearly 18% of farm production, there are 3.2% of farms classified as large that contribute 46.5% of our nation's farm production. All farms are valuable. This farm bill will not neglect the small nor punish the large. We must also acknowledge that programs within this farm bill that relate to trade promotion, research, basic infrastructure, and rural communities bolstering the infrastructure to protect our flocks and herds, and so many other important programs must be considered. This farm bill covers much more than simply conservation, nutrition, and green energy, which have received a $300 billion windfall since the last farm bill.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The latest consumer price index shows grocery store food prices continuing their upward march, but by smaller monthly steps than we've seen over the last couple of years.
This does look more like what we would have expected in the pre-COVID pandemic era.
USDA economist Matt McLaughlin says those prices at grocery stores did go up during February, but only by 0.3%, not the 2% and 3% monthly increases we've been used to seeing. The CPI report does show February's grocery store food prices on average 10.2% higher than February a year ago. But back in January, remember that number was
11.4%.
So food price inflation appears to be slowing down. However, before we get too excited, Matt says for this year, he expects the rate of price increase to slow down. Yes, but
we do not expect decreases. Price decreases are pretty unusual.
In fact, he says food prices in general could rise another 8% or so this year. Gary Crawford, Washington.